For this February 2nd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. House Democrats today unveiling an in-depth outline of their legal case against former President Donald Trump for his alleged role in the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. The Democrats, in an 80-page trial brief, describing the former president as responsible for the events at the Capitol that led to the destruction and five deaths. In response, the president's lawyers writing the following, quote, incitement of insurrection against him as moot and thus in violation of the U.S. Constitution because the Senate lacks the jurisdiction to remove from office a man who does not hold office. The Senate trial begins in 1 week. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is freeing up an additional $1.3 billion in relief funding to Puerto Rico as it moves to ease some of the restrictions that were put in place during the previous administration. The Senate taking up a number of cabinet nominees. And in Moscow, Russian dissident Alexei Navalny was ordered to serve up to 32 months in prison after a court ruled today that he violated terms of his parole. Navalny remains one of President Vladimir Putin's fiercest critics. He was taken into custody on January 17th after returning from Germany, where he had been recovering for 5 months from being poisoned with a nerve agent. The Biden administration is calling today's sentencing, quote, deeply disturbing. The story shaping Washington today. Ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin with the impeachment story. House Democrats and former President Trump's legal team each offering their arguments today, describing how they will approach the historic Senate trial scheduled to begin next Tuesday against the 45th president. House prosecutors saying that former President Trump aimed a mob of supporters, quote, like a loaded cannon before the deadly riots that took place on January the 6th. In response, the president's legal team arguing the trial would be unconstitutional because he's a private citizen. We'll talk to one of the Washington Post reporters following this story in just a moment. But first, the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
Senator Schumer, how concerned are you that the former president's legal team is going to introduce once again his conspiracy theories about the past election and make that a part of his impeachment defense?
Well, I hope if they tried to do that and couldn't answer the defense that Republicans would see that and realize that they have no argument against the charges brought by the House managers.
This is the headline this evening at WashingtonPost.com. Trump's actions described as, quote, a betrayal of historic proportions. Amy Gardner, national political reporter, is following that story. And let me begin with this 80-page brief by congressional Democrats. What stands out?
So a couple of points, really. First of all, they lean into their view that President Trump is guilty, in their view, of high crimes and misdemeanors, which, as we know, is the threshold laid out in the Constitution for convicting a federal office holder in an impeachment trial. The justification for that conclusion relies on a lot of really lofty and historical language. They quote the Federalist Papers. They contrast former President Trump's efforts to stay in office despite his electoral loss with, you know, George Washington's insistence that he relinquish the presidency after two terms to preserve the democracy and prevent tyranny. Basically they say if a president inciting his supporters to interrupt a joint session of Congress fulfilling its constitutional duty isn't an impeachable offense, what is? So that's the really powerful and sort of emotional or sort of impassioned takeaway from the House Democrats' argument.
And so having reviewed the document from your standpoint as a reporter covering the story, how convincing is it 1 week before the trial gets underway?
Well, they lay out substantial evidence that President Trump's words incited rioters to go down to the Capitol and storm the Capitol. They cite his questions about the election results, his claims that don't have evidence to support them, that he lost the election as a result of widespread fraud. They also play on emotions, but they present an emotional case to remind Republicans who might be planning to vote against conviction of what it was like that day. There are some pretty dramatic reminders of the details that they don't want people to forget about what it was like on January 6th. You know, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's staff hiding under a table in the dark for hours while they listened to rioters right outside the door that was right there. Representative Jamie Raskin, the Maryland Democrat who is the leader of the impeachment managers, you know, exhorting his chief of staff to protect his daughter and son-in-law, whom he had brought to the Capitol in part to be with his family just a few days after his son had died. You know, Capitol Police being harmed, 140 police officers injured, one dead, two dead subsequently of suicide. There's a lot of emotion in this document. So, you know, will it convince anyone who is not planning to vote for impeachment? I think that we just don't know that yet.
We're talking with Amy Gardner of The Washington Post, and as you indicated, that January 6th rally, really the centerpiece for Democrats. How are the president's lawyers responding? I know they filed a 14-page response earlier today.
It's really interesting. They're not denying really any of the facts that the Democrats lay out. They're not denying what Trump said at the rally. They're not denying what he said about election fraud. They're not denying that he called Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and asked him to find the votes to switch the results in Georgia for him. But they are denying that those things were problematic or inappropriate. They're denying that his language at the rally on the morning of January 6th incited anybody. And they're denying that he was urging Raffensperger to commit a crime. He was simply saying, if you go back and do an examination, you will find that I actually won. That's sort of what they say. They're also claiming that he is entitled to believe that the election was stolen, that that's a matter of free speech, which is an interesting argument that the Democrats will have already argued in their brief is not true. The First Amendment does not give you the right to incite an insurrection. So, you know, they're basically saying, sure, he said all these things, but no, he didn't incite, and he has a right to say them. They're also, their main legal argument is that it is unconstitutional to impeach a former president, and they make that point multiple times in their 14-page response.
And I guess the other leading question tonight, will there be witnesses? Will House Democratic managers or the president's defense team be calling witnesses next week?
We don't know. We don't expect to know possibly until the trial begins next week on Tuesday. The House managers would love to call witnesses. They would love to call, for instance, police officers. I think there's a great desire to make the Republican senators who want to impose conviction sit through the testimony of injured law enforcement officers who put their lives on the line to protect those senators and also other members of Congress. You know, as the party of law enforcement, the party of law and order, the Republicans might find that to be an uncomfortable moment. But Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans alike are reluctant to allow witness testimony. Democrats are worried that it would cause the trial to drag on for as long as 2 to 3 weeks. That would delay the focus of attention that they want to turn back to President Biden's agenda, COVID relief, and so on. And Republicans, of course, would prefer not to dwell on the insurrection and Trump's fixation on believing or claiming to believe that he won the election, because they understand that it divides not just the country, but their own party, and is not helpful for them. So the Senate seems inclined not to want to do this, and they're the ones who set the rules. So we'll find out next week what those rules will be.
More details tonight at WashingtonPost.com and in tomorrow's newspaper. Amy Gardner, national political reporter, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And so as congressional leaders deal with the uprising last month in the U.S. Capitol and the looming impeachment trial of President Trump, Republicans also dealing with the controversy over Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Again today, the freshman lawmaker facing some sharp criticism from Democrats and from Republicans for her many conspiracies about American politics. In a statement issued last night, this from the Senate GOP leader, Mitch McConnell, quote, "Loony lies and conspiracy theories are cancer for the Republican Party and our country. Somebody who has suggested that perhaps no airplane hit the Pentagon on 9/11, that horrifying school shootings were pre-staged, and that the Clintons crashed JFK Jr.'s airplane is not living in reality." And Senator McConnell went on to state, quote, "This has nothing to do with the challenges facing American families or the robust debates on substance that can strengthen our party." Now, while not mentioning her by name, a clear reference to the comments made by Congresswoman Green, and today, further response from the Senate leader.
Have you spoken to Leader McCarthy about Marjorie Taylor Greene or Liz Cheney? What outcome would you like to see with them, and why did you choose to weigh in on them yesterday?
Well, first of all, Leader McCarthy and I have a good working relationship. I did yesterday express myself on that particular new member of the House, and I think I adequately spoke out about how I feel about any effort to define the Republican Party in such a way. I think that pretty well covers my view on that.
Do you wish, though, you spoke out about Donald Trump's conspiracies about the election being stolen much earlier than you ultimately did?
Well, with regard to the former president, we're going into an impeachment trial next week. We're all going to listen to what the lawyers have to say and making the arguments and work our way through it.
And a reminder, we'll have live coverage of the impeachment trial next Tuesday, live on C-SPAN 2. That the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Meanwhile, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee launching an early six-figure ad campaign tying House Republicans to the QAnon conspiracy theory and to Representative Green. The ad campaign is the first of the 2020 midterm election cycle, the DCCC targeting eight House Republicans. Here is one example of those ads.
QAnon, a conspiracy theory born online, took over the Republican Party, sent followers to Congress, and with Donald Trump, incited a mob that attacked the Capitol and murdered a cop. Then Trump and Republicans in Congress sided with the violent QAnon mob. Congressman Mike Garcia should have stood with us, but he was a coward. He voted to protect Trump. Congressman Mike Garcia, he stood with Q, not you. DCCC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Scott Wong of The Hill newspaper, TheHill.com, is following this story. He is joining us on the phone here in Washington. How would you best describe exactly what is going on within the Republican Party?
Well, Steve, you know, what we're seeing is the two wings of the Republican Party, the pro-Trump wing and the establishment wing, really battling it out for control of the party in this post-Trump, post-President Trump world. And so what we're seeing is this battle exemplified by these two Republican lawmakers. One, Liz Cheney, who we know very well, the daughter of Vice President Dick Cheney, who is one of the highest ranking Republican leader in Congress, a female leader, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who exemplifies the pro-Trump wing. She is a very conservative lawmaker. She has been identified by her belief in many of these conspiracy theories, you know, concerning 9/11, concerning mass school shootings. And so we are seeing this play out really in the next couple days here. Things are really coming to a head where Kevin McCarthy and the Republican conference in the House will have to decide the fate of these two leaders. You know, will Marjorie Taylor Greene be ousted from her committee assignments because of some of these extreme beliefs that she holds that many in the party see as toxic to the party? And whether Liz Cheney, because she supported the impeachment of President Trump, will she face that backlash and be removed as the GOP conference chairwoman We should know the answer to both of those questions probably in the next 48 hours.
And we already know that Liz Cheney is going to be challenged in her home state. But in terms of support or lack thereof among her House Republican colleagues, how much pressure is there to remove her from the number three position in the House?
Well, I think there are very vocal members of the pro-Trump wing of the party right now, namely Matt Gaetz and a handful of others, Andy Biggs, the Freedom Caucus chairman, who are clamoring for Liz Cheney to either resign as GOP conference chairwoman or to be forced out. And so what we're sort of waiting to see is whether they call a special meeting of House Republicans tomorrow to weigh that very question, whether they take that drastic step. I don't think we've seen that step taken, the removal of a member of leadership in decades, certainly not in my memory. I don't know if it's ever happened before. But, you know, we saw Matt Gaetz, the Republican, pro-Trump Republican congressman from Florida, travel to Cheney's home district in Wyoming to rally a crowd of Trump supporters in urging Cheney's ouster. You know, that is certainly something rare that we've seen. And so all of these events sort of underscore the tensions in the party right now as Republicans try to figure out whether to continue to embrace President Trump as the leader of their party, or as Liz Cheney and Mitch McConnell would say, to try to turn the page on President Trump. Given the fact that he, number one, he lost the White House, he cost Republicans the House of Representatives in the 2018 midterms, and now he has, some would argue that he has cost Republicans control of the Senate, given that the two Georgia seats flipped in the runoff elections after Trump left office. And so we're seeing, you know, this play out in very dramatic form, in particular over these next couple days here.
We're talking with Scott Wong, his work available at thehill.com. Let's turn to House Democrats and what options they have with regard to pressure to remove the freshman representative from Georgia from her seat, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, in recent days, we had heard Democrats call on Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, to remove her from two of her committees that she had just recently been assigned as a freshman lawmaker. One is the Budget Committee. The second is much more interesting, the Education and Workforce Committee, because in recent days we have learned, or it's come to light from reporting from CNN and others, that she had she had espoused some conspiracy theorist views that the mass school shootings in Parkland, Florida, and Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut were hoaxes, as she called them. And so that has created added scrutiny with her appointment to the Education Committee. Now, Democrats are putting pressure on McCarthy and have continued to do so, most recently with a new resolution by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Florida congresswoman, the former DNC chairwoman, who wants to call a vote on the House floor later this week to remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from those two committees, bring that resolution to the House floor, put all House members on record. They say that unless McCarthy takes action first in the next 48 hours, they intend to do so. And so this is the jam that Kevin McCarthy finds him in. He is really between a rock and a hard place. He understands that he is under enormous pressure, to distance the party from some of these extremist views by Marjorie Taylor Greene. At the same time, he cannot alienate a lot of these Trump supporters who align themselves with Marjorie Taylor Greene and with President Trump. He needs President Trump to activate the base and really turn out Republican voters in the upcoming 2022 midterm election. He feels he is right on the cusp because of that narrow majority. He feels he's on the verge of the speakership, but he is having to walk this very fine line of you know, not alienating moderate suburban voters while also not alienating the pro-Trump base that he'll need to win back the majority.
And, of course, as the story unfolds, live coverage of the House on C-SPAN television and your reporting at The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. Scott Wong, as always, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
On Wall Street, big gains for the Dow, jumping 475 points, the NASDAQ rising almost 210, and the S&P was up 52.5. In news on Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, he's also the owner of the Washington Post, the company announcing today he will step down as chief executive of the e-commerce giant in a statement saying, quote, turning over the reins to the company's longtime cloud computing boss, Andy Jassy. Jeff Bezos will transition to the role of executive chair in the third quarter. At the Pentagon today, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ousted hundreds of members of the department's advisory committees, and by doing so, removing last-minute appointees by the Trump administration. Secretary Austin firing all members serving on the DOD advisory boards and also ordering the immediate suspension of all advisory committee operations until the review is completed. That's effective February the 16th. CBS Pentagon correspondent David Martin with this line of questioning to spokesperson John Kirby.
David Martin, you are on the phone. Is that right?
I am. I think you said in the statement on advisory committees that the secretary was concerned about the pace of change. Can you tell us that this review was a specific reaction to all of the dismissals and appointments in the final days of the Trump administration?
There's no question, David, that the frenetic activity that occurred to the composition of so many boards in just the period of November to January deeply concerned the secretary and certainly helped drive him to this decision. Yes.
And that announcement earlier today from the Pentagon spokesperson and the immediate suspension of all Defense Department Advisory Committee operations. Two FBI agents were killed, three others injured as they were serving a warrant in South Florida this morning in one of the deadliest shootings in the Bureau's history. The FBI is saying that the shooting occurred just after 6 o'clock this morning. It came as the agents descended on an apartment complex in the city of Sunrise. That, by the way, is just west of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The agents were serving a warrant related to a case involving violent crimes against children, including pornography and sexual abuse. Officials saying that the man being investigated had apparently barricaded himself inside the complex and was found dead. You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. It is Tuesday, February 2nd, and here are some of your political headlines. With last week's announcement that Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio will retire when his term expires in 2022, the scramble is on, the political scramble. On the Democratic side, Congressman Tim Ryan, he represents the Youngstown area, is expected to formally enter the race in early March. In Florida, Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist saying he is open to challenging Governor Ron DeSantis next year. Charlie Crist served as the Florida governor for one term from 2007 until 2011. He'd ran for the U.S. Senate and lost. Former RNC chair and MSNBC contributor Michael Steele saying he is considering a run for governor of Maryland next year. Michael Steele previously served as the state's lieutenant governor and was also the head of the Republican National Committee. He told TheHill.com that he is taking, quote, a strong and long look at it. And he served as a member of Congress from the Chicago area, President Obama's first White House chief of staff. He's also the former mayor of Chicago. NBC News is reporting that President Biden is considering Rahm Emanuel for a high-profile ambassadorship, potentially to China or to Japan. More details at NBCNews.com. Here in Washington, the confirmation process continues as the president tries to get his cabinet in place. With six Republicans joining the Democrats, the Senate today approving the nomination of Alejandro Mayorkas to head up the Department of Homeland Security. The final vote was 56 to 43. Born in Havana, Cuba, Mayorkas would be the first immigrant to serve as the head of the Department of Homeland Security. Democratic Delaware Senator Tom Carper endorsing the nomination.
The Department of Homeland Security has been without a Senate-confirmed secretary for 21 months. Think about that, 21 months. Meanwhile, there's no shortage of work to be done, from the clear and present threat of domestic terrorism to responding to the SolarWinds cyber breach to helping distribute the COVID vaccine. Now more than ever, it's crucial for this important department to be led by men and women who have been vetted and confirmed by members of this body. The American people deserve a capable leader at the helm of this department. And I believe that leader is Alejandro Mayorkas. Ali represents the best of America. Born in Havana, Cuba, Ali knows firsthand what it's like for a family to flee its native land and come to the United States in search of refuge. He's a man of integrity, person of principle who possesses a truly, truly remarkable work ethic. What's more, he may well be the most qualified nominee we've ever been asked to consider to lead the Department of Homeland Security. He has previously served admirably as deputy secretary for nearly 4 years, and before that as the head of DHS's largest agency, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. As director of this agency, he worked to combat immigration fraud. He directed and implemented the DACA program to protect hundreds of thousands of Dreamers, and much more. As deputy secretary, he led the department's successful unity of effort initiative to improve morale at an agency which previously had the lowest morale of any large agency in our federal government. In fact, the department there reported the greatest improvement in morale in the final year of the Obama administration was the Department of Homeland Security, in large part due to Ali's leadership and that of former Secretary Jay Johnson.
From the Senate floor, Tom Carper, Democrat of Delaware. The nomination did face Republican criticism. In his opening speech this morning, Leader Mitch McConnell calling the president's choice, quote, an ethically compromised partisan lawyer. During the Obama administration, Alejandro Mayorkas did head up the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Senator McConnell brought up an inspector general report that found Mayorkas intervened to help foreign investors in the EB-5 visa program who were connected to top Democrats. And there was this from Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee.
When he served as USCIS director during the Obama administration, the inspector general was forced to investigate, quote, an extraordinary, end quote, number of internal allegations that Mayorkas was granting special access and special favors to wealthy EB-5 investor visa applicants linked to influential Democrats. When the IG took a closer look at the visa applications for three powerful Chinese nationals in particular, they came to the conclusion that if Mayorkas hadn't intervened, and I'm quoting, the matter would have been decided differently, end quote. Now, Mr. President, this is something that we know is inappropriate. We know that this is something for which Mr. Mayorkas should be held accountable. We know that this is something for which he has not been held accountable. And here is what he did. He put his thumb on the scale, pressured his DHS colleagues, to break their own rules and turn the law on its head, all because a few powerful friends asked him to do it. He pressured others for the benefit of some powerful friends. And it is all there for everyone to read in the Inspector General's report, and yet he was never held accountable. And yet, here we are being asked to support his nomination to the president's cabinet.
Now, that debate over the president's nominee to head up the Department of Homeland Security, Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. Despite some Republican opposition, six GOP senators did support the Democrats in the Mayorkas nomination. They are Capito of West Virginia, Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska, Portman of Ohio, Romney of Utah, and Sullivan of Alaska. Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania did not vote. Again, final confirmation vote 56-43 in favor of his nomination. Also on the Senate floor, the nomination of Pete Buttigieg by a vote of 86-13. The former South Bend, Indiana mayor and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate confirmed as the next transportation secretary. Washington Senator Maria Cantwell, the incoming chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, with these remarks.
Mr. President, I come to the floor today to support the nomination of Pete Buttigieg to be Secretary of Transportation. We all know the nominee as Mayor Pete, a man who basically came onto the national stage as a Midwest mayor who had lots of enthusiasm for making investments in America's future. So today we're considering his nomination to be Secretary of Transportation at a time when we need a lot of work done on transportation. And in my opinion, he's a young, energetic mayor who is going to help us usher in a new era of transportation. That means there's going to be a lot of bipartisan dialogue about how we get there. But this job should not be underestimated in the importance that the transportation sector and the investments for the future need. That is that our transportation system serves as a backbone of our economy. And when it's not doing well, the consequential impacts of that affect our economy. It affects how our businesses compete in a global economy. It affects how people get to and from work, and it affects their home life as well. So it's a big job that we have, and I know that this mayor and future Secretary of Transportation understands how big this challenge is.
That from Senator Maria Cantwell, as lawmakers confirming Pete Buttigieg serving as the next transportation secretary, and he is making history as the first openly gay member of a presidential cabinet. Meanwhile, the Senate Agriculture Committee taking up the nomination of Tom Vilsack. He is the former Iowa governor. He also headed up the Ag Department during the Obama administration and is President Biden's pick to return to that cabinet post. Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, who now chairs the committee, with this line of questioning to Tom Vilsack.
I want to start first with just the farm economy in general. We've seen such tumultuous years now for our farmers and ranchers. We've seen government payments replace markets as the main driver of farm profitability, and I share with Senator Bozeman's concern about markets and trade and what we need to do to get stability back for our farmers and our ranchers. We're going to continue to have challenges, we know, because of the pandemic and it moving forward. It is good to see bright spots like corn and soybean wheat prices recently hitting their highest in the last 6 years. That's good news. But taking a step back, how can we return to a sense of normalcy in the farm economy with a focus on responsible risk management and building markets for producers, which really has been the foundation of our farm bills in recent years?
Senator, that's an incredibly complicated question, and I'll do my best to try to respond in a short period of time. It indeed starts with markets. Historically, we've obviously looked at export market opportunities. Anywhere from 20-30% of what's produced in this country gets exported. So clearly a stable, secure trade policy that doesn't create havoc in the market, that doesn't put us at a competitive disadvantage would be helpful in terms of our ability to sell product overseas. Expanding market opportunities in new market, I think Southeast Asia is an opportunity. I think eventually over time, we're going to see potential opportunities in Africa. One half of the world's increased population is liable to come in the next 15 years in that single continent. So we want to obviously be engaged in trade opportunities there as they evolve. Certainly our competitors are doing that. But it's more than just export markets. It's growing markets here domestically. By investing in a robust local and regional food system that creates market opportunities for small and mid-sized producers so they can negotiate their own price. We began that process in the Obama administration, but I think there's much, much more work that could be done in that space. It's about creating new markets, markets that have never been developed before. Carbon sequestration and storage, if done the right way. The opportunity for methane capture and reuse, if done the right way. The development of bio-based manufacturing that creates new market opportunities for agricultural waste, if done the right way, can all create a more stable farm income and economy, and can also help to create and support the jobs that many farm families need as well in rural places. It's also about making sure that we have a safety net that operates. I mean, our farmers are definitely more interested in markets than they are aid, but there are times and circumstances that it requires significant investment by the government. We need to be prepared to do that. We need policies and programs that allow and enable that. And we need, obviously, a strong crop insurance program that provides protection in the event that Mother Nature simply won't cooperate. So it's all of that and probably much, much more. But
thank you.
Just some of the issues that Tom Vilsack expected to be confirmed as the next Agriculture Secretary, and questioning from Senator Debbie Stabenow, the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, earlier today. Meanwhile, President Biden has spent his first couple of weeks in office signing a number of executive orders, actually dozens of them, from COVID-19 testing to the environment, basically allowing him to move on his administration's plans without congressional approval. However, to enact his $1.9 trillion stimulus plan and send a third stimulus check to those Americans who qualify, the president will need 60 votes in the Senate. That means 10 Republican votes in the evenly split Senate to approve a new stimulus check, and then some. Well, in a two-hour meeting with Senate Republicans yesterday in the Oval Office, it proved useful in terms of showing bipartisanship, but at the moment, both sides remain far apart. So that leaves two options for the White House. One is to spend the next few weeks negotiating the details of package with Senate Republicans. There is another tool, however, that would bypass objections in both the Senate and the House. The term is budget reconciliation. It's used here in Washington. It means it would make it possible to pass the stimulus bill in both the House and the Senate with just a simple majority of the votes. At today's House Rules Committee hearing today, here's how that debate unfolded with the chair of the House Budget Committee before the Rules Committee, Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky.
The need is clear. We are experiencing record COVID infections and deaths. Millions are unemployed and small businesses are closing every day. The plan has strong bipartisan support from the people we represent. Polling shows that 74% of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, support the relief measures laid out in the package. And not just the relief package in general, the specific targeted provisions in the bill. Is it the price tag? Economists across the ideological spectrum agree that not doing this relief package will cost us far more. That we are moving too fast? January was the deadliest month yet for COVID. Every 28 seconds, an American died from the coronavirus. We don't need to slow down. We need to hurry the hell up. The resolution's budget reconciliation framework sets a budgetary target of up to $1.9 trillion, the estimated cost of the American Rescue Plan, allocated across the 12 House committees that have jurisdiction over some portion of the plan. The resolution instructs these committees to report legislation consistent with these budgetary targets to the Budget Committee by February 16. The Budget Committee will then combine the legislation and prepare it for floor consideration. This budget resolution does not provide a comprehensive fiscal blueprint for the next 10 years. Once this vital relief package becomes law, Congress can begin its work on a forward-looking, comprehensive budget resolution for 2022. The quicker we act, the more lives can be saved, and the faster our economy will recover. We welcome Republican support, but are prepared to move forward without it. The human and economic costs are far too great.
And that from today's House Rules Committee hearing on the budget reconciliation debate, and responding to the chair of the House Budget Committee is Republican Congressman Jason Smith, the ranking member.
What is most troublesome here is not the process, but the policies. What has been put forward by the majority is merely a vehicle, a means to an end, which is to use reconciliation to enact a slew of policies that will harm America's working class, increase the cost of living for American families, destroy jobs, and weaken the economy. I'd like to remind the gentleman from Kentucky that his state government has already received a $5 billion bailout and will receive another $4.7 billion under this proposal. While that very same government has enacted lockdown policies directly lending to the closure of more than 1,000 small businesses in Kentucky. If we want to deliver something useful for the American people, we must start with proper collaboration. Moving forward with a vague shell of a budget will do nothing more than tarnish the nation's trust in Congress and divide us even further. It is extremely important for this body to recognize the importance of enacting legislation that may benefit all Americans. Instead, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are using reconciliation and the pandemic as a way to ram through a progressive agenda. They must do better.
Before moving to the House floor, that argument earlier today from Republican Congressman Jason Smith. He is a member of the Budget Committee testifying before the House Rules Committee. The full hearing available on our website at cspan.org. On the Senate side, reaction from the two leaders will begin with Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York.
Now, we had a really good virtual caucus meeting with two very special guest speakers. It was great to have President Biden and Treasury Secretary Yellen join our meeting. President Biden spoke about the need for Congress to respond boldly and quickly. He was very strong in emphasizing the need for a big, bold package. He said that he told Senate Republicans that the $600 billion that they proposed was way too small. I think it is his belief, it is Secretary Yellen's belief, it is our belief. If we did a package that small, we'd be mired in the COVID crisis for years. And we are not going to make the mistake of 2009 and have too small a package that took too long, and it took 4 or 5 years for the economy to recover. President Biden said he told Republicans he's willing to make some modifications, but he's very strong that the full American Rescue Plan get us through this crisis. Secretary Yellen said the Republican $600 billion wasn't close to enough, and specifically noted that it didn't do enough to help low-income families because it excluded the EITC and the CTC. She also said we can't repeat the same mistakes of 2009. The whole country, maybe except some in the Republican caucus, seemed to understand that. And by the way, it was pointed out at our lunch that there is overwhelming support for the ARP. Democrats, Republicans, independents, all by a majority, support a bold plan and support going through reconciliation if we have to.
That from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer earlier today, and this from the Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
I talked to the president yesterday morning, and then, as all of you know and have reported, he met with 10 of our members for a couple of hours last night. And at lunch, we had an opportunity to talk to the members who were in the meeting, hoping that we could find a bipartisan way forward. Our members who were in the meeting felt that the president seemed to be more interested in that than his staff did, or that it seems like the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate are. So here's where I think we're headed. It looks like the majority is going to have us vote on the motion to proceed to the budget this afternoon. They've chosen a totally partisan path. I can't remember a budget in the time that I've been here that either side has ever voted in a bipartisan way, so we're off to a totally partisan start. I think that's unfortunate. I think our 10 members laid out a proposal that could have gotten broad bipartisan support, given the new administration a chance to get a bipartisan victory here early, but they are in the majority in the House and Senate. And life is a series of choices, and they've chosen. So we'll go down that path. That means we'll be facing multiple amendments later in the week.
That from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, and the politics and debate over the issue of reconciliation and President Biden's proposal of a $1.9 trillion stimulus bill that the Biden administration says must pass. As we mentioned earlier today, two FBI agents fatally shot, three others were wounded in a shootout as those agents were proceeding with a search warrant in Sunrise, Florida, which is outside of Fort Lauderdale. It took place this morning at just past 6 a.m. The search warrant involving an individual alleged to have violent crimes against children. And late today, this response from President Biden in the Oval Office.
Now, our hearts go out to the families of those FBI special agents, and two of whom were killed, and three of whom were injured today in Florida. I was briefed in this tragedy earlier today, and I know the FBI is gathering information about how this happened, what happened, but I can only imagine how these families are feeling today. You know, one of the things when you are in a combat zone as a military, or you're a FBI agent or military or a police officer, every family just when they put that shield on and go out in the morning dreads the possibility of a call, receiving that phone call. And my heart aches for the families. I've not had an opportunity, nor will I try today, to contact them, but they put their lives on the line, and it's a hell of a price to pay. And every single day, every single one of these folks get up, and they, by and large, the vast, vast majority of these men and women are decent, honorable people who put themselves on the line. We owe them.
And that update late today from the president in the Oval Office. Again, two agents dead, three others wounded, and the suspect involved in this case has also died. Meanwhile, the Biden administration announcing plans today to begin distributing a limited number of COVID-19 vaccine doses directly to retail pharmacies across the nation. Under this new program, the federal government will ship doses directly to those pharmacies, including Rite Aid, Walgreens, and CVS. The pharmacies are also part of a separate federal program to vaccinate residents of long-term care facilities. Jeff Zients is a White House response coordinator for this pandemic.
Starting on February 11th, the federal government will deliver vaccines directly to select pharmacies across the country. This will provide more sites for people to get vaccinated in their communities, and it's an important component to delivering vaccines equitably. This pharmacy program will expand access in neighborhoods across the country so you can make an appointment and get your shot conveniently and quickly. But I wanted to set expectations appropriately. Due to the current supply constraints, this will be limited when it begins next week. In this first phase of the program, supply will be at only about 6,500 stores nationwide before expanding. And in the early phase, many pharmacies across the country will not have vaccine or may have very limited supply. People should first make sure they meet their state's eligibility requirements for vaccinations and then check availability on their local pharmacy's website. Equity is at the core of how the Center for Disease Control is working with states to select pharmacy partners for this first phase. Sites are selected based on their ability to reach some of the populations most at risk for severe illness from COVID-19, including socially vulnerable communities. And the CDC will monitor the data on an ongoing basis to make sure that pharmacies are efficiently and equitably administering vaccinations. This initial phase of activating local pharmacies will get more shots in arms and will ensure that pharmacies have the infrastructure and the experience they need to scale up when vaccine supply increases in the months ahead. Eventually, as we're able to increase supply, up to 40,000 pharmacies nationwide could provide COVID-19 vaccinations. These are places ranging from local independent pharmacies to national pharmacies and supermarkets. This is a critical step to provide the public with convenient, trusted places to get vaccinated in their communities.
Jeff Zients, he is the White House response coordinator for COVID-19, and the Biden administration, again, hoping to get 100 million vaccines or more 100 days of the new administration. The White House is also hoping to reopen most K through 8 schools by April, as the administration directing the Departments of Education and Health and Human Services to draft guidelines to make that happen. Well, you probably saw it on YouTube that British captain, Sir Tom Moore, He raised $45 million for Britain's naval health services. He did so by shuffling laps across his garden with the aid of a walker during the nationwide coronavirus lockdown last year. He died earlier today. Sir Tom Moore was 100 years old. He was knighted last year by Queen Elizabeth for his charitable campaign. He spent the last few weeks being treated for pneumonia. He tested positive for coronavirus last week. Again, the passing of Sir Tom Moore in Great Britain. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.